Welcome to the Stanley Street Social Podcast, proudly presented by MAP. Before we get underway, if you could all hit subscribe on however you consume your podcasts, whether it's on iTunes, Spotify, whatever it is, hit subscribe. It's going to go a long way to helping us grow. If you could also like the content on our socials, give us a follow, even share this content on your own social platform, it will go a really long way to helping us grow. So thanks for listening to the podcast, and we really hope you enjoy this episode. This is an episode of the Shimano Summer Series, proudly brought to you by Shimano. This series is about giving a wider insight into the world of cycling. We talk to some riders, we talk to some staff, we talk to agents, just to give you a broader insight onto the world of professional cycling. So we hope you enjoy this series, and a big thanks to Shimano for making it happen. Today's guest on the podcast is the 2019 National Champion on the Road, Michael Freeburg. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. We're here at Cadell's. You're racing for the national team here.
Yep, first World Tour race.
Pretty keen to get into it.
Yeah, really excited. Last night we had the Albert Park team point score.
Interesting.
Oh, absolutely ridiculous. It was so hot. Like, I heard there was a lot of Sidalgo throwing up down the back straight from heatstroke. Like, this race was incredible. Good format. I reckon it could work really well in the future, but it was just ridiculous out there yesterday.
So you think it has potential to be a good event?
Yeah, I think so. You see it in the Hammer Series. Like, everyone gets into it. The teams love it. Good for the crowd and stuff. But yeah, a bit hot.
So people know that you won the Nationals a couple of weeks ago, but some people might not know about your history in cycling. You've done a lot, haven't you, in the sport?
I've been around for a while.
Dating back to probably Junior Worlds in Mexico. Is that kind of your first?
South Africa. Yep.
Kind of your first run on the world scene?
Yeah, basically. So in that year, I can't even remember what year it was actually, South Africa. But I got the spot there by winning the under-19 National Road Time Trial. So
yep.
I was first, and then Rowan, and then Durbo. And then actually the next day, Durbo went out and won the road race.
How'd you go on the roadie?
I was just somewhere in the pack, yeah. There wasn't many people left, so yeah.
How'd you go at Worlds?
I actually cramped. I think I got like 15th or something, so I didn't have a good day that day. One of the first big international race trips. I didn't really know how to handle myself as an athlete and stuff. Real young. I think probably like drank too much water because I was too excited in the lead up, and then just depleted my salts and cramped on the day. But yeah, you sort of work on those things as you develop as an athlete.
Was that second year 19s?
Yep, that would have been second year 19s.
So
yeah.
What happened after that? Did you go into the track program, do some World Cups, World Championships on the track?
No, actually. Let me think back. It was sort of, I was back on the road. I think the first team I can remember was the Virgin Blue guys, with Chris White, who's the team owner, and Hank Vogels, and Paddy Yonker. Paddy Yonker was actually our DS, and we were based out of Brizzy, and had a great time. That was our little road program, the NRS, and then the year after that, stepped up to, I think it was Com Games, actually. So I was still doing a little bit on the track. It's all so very
that was,
blurry,
was that
actually.
Delhi 2010?
Yeah, Delhi Com Games. So yeah. That was great. I think they ran out of riders for that, and they were like, oh, bugger, we need someone to fill in the team shoot spot. And so I'd been on the fringes there. I was doing okay. And then Ian McKenzie put me into track camp for 2 months in Adelaide by myself. And then I went and stepped into another month of track camp in Eagle with the team when I got there.
So what do you mean by yourself? You were just in Adelaide?
Just me and Macca.
Just two up.
Just the two up. Yep. I was out there. They had a house. I was just there by myself. And me and Macca would go out on the motorbike, and he'd just follow behind me, and I'd do my efforts, and he'd just sit behind me for 180K. And then I won a golden team shoot and silver in the scratch race there, and Cam won the scratch race at Delhi, yeah.
And what, were you 2011, was that World Omnium champ?
Yeah, so basically my ride in the Com Games sort of helped me get a bit more confidence with the national track program, and then they offered me a spot to race the World Cups for the Omnium. So at the time, they didn't have an Omnium rider that was doing very well. And basically Ian McKenzie came to me and said, oh, look, if you can get 10th place or better in the next two World Cups, we'll give you a spot at Worlds. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to grab onto this with both hands. yeah, and so it actually worked pretty well for me. I think I got 2 5th places, just sort of testing out different tactics and trying to learn the bunch and stuff like that. Because racing at a World Cup level, like point score or elimination. Elimination is ridiculous. Point score, elimination, scratch race is completely different to anything you see in Australia. Like the speed is so much faster. The racing is completely different. Nothing like what you race at nationals at all. And yeah, the racing suited me. Because it's just a little bit different to what you see at nationals. And then
what's so different about it?
It's just more flowing. Whereas nationals, you sort of like watch each other and there's three guys in, like each state team has three riders. So you can, there's a bit of teamwork and stuff, yeah. But at the world level, fortune favors the brave. You go on the attack, you go on another attack, and then eventually something will stick. You take a lap, you get up, and then you're sprinting against three guys, and that sort of stuff like really suited me. Yeah,
was that kind of your last hit out on the track that season? Because the year after 2012, you're with Jayco AIS on the road.
So that was still 2011. So I won the World Championships in Apeldoorn. So they gave me the qualifying spots and I was a bit of an underdog. And then I managed to win the world title there. I still remember it actually very vividly. It's one of those things you don't really forget. I had some good form that week. And we had the first day, it was like a flying 200 where I placed about 10th better than average, and then we went to do a point score where I went okay. I just missed a few tactical errors, and then elimination, world level elimination. Like, guys, this is absolutely ridiculous. I don't know how you can put this into a race. Like, if you've got the best from every country fighting for not being last across the line, like, you're rubbing wheels. I remember leaning my front five spoke on someone's disc for like a good half lap just because there was nowhere to go. You just get comfortable with it, and that's what you got to do. But yeah, in the scratch race the next day, it was really interesting position. So I went half a lap up with Shane Archibald and Viviani, and they were a couple of points in front of me, so I was sitting in third. Then I was like, oh man, this is really not going to work, because if we take a lap, I'll still be in third position and I'll just move them further ahead. So what I did was, and the thing that basically won me the world title was I swung up to the top of the track, went to the last wheel and sat there. And these two guys tried to hold off the bunch, which was gaining on them. And I think actually Matt Gilmore walked off the track at that point. Matt Gilmore was my coach and he's like, what is this guy doing?
I thought you were just going rogue.
Yeah, I've just gone rogue and I'm completely stuffed up. He's like, you're in the winning break. What have you done? You've gone to the back of the field. But then eventually Matty came back on the track and he's seen me going down the road with seven guys and not the two guys in front of me. And we took a lap and then I ended up winning the bunch kick. Matt told me to follow the Spanish bloke, rolled him in the sprint. And then that put something like 8 points between me and Viviani and Archibald. And then they couldn't catch me in the kilos, which was pretty cool.
What was your best event in the Omnium?
Definitely the scratch race. Yeah, I think I podiumed in every scratch race I rode, which was pretty cool. Yeah.
So then after that Worlds, you're world champion. What did you do for the rest of that season before that year on the road with Jayco AIS?
Yeah, so that season I went, I signed with Fly V Australia, which is based out of America. So I lived in Colorado for a year racing pro. That was fantastic.
That was cool.
Yeah, that was real cool. So I got in a wage and been pro bike rider for a year. Hank Vogels was our DS and he brought a lot of experience to me and the team. And you just learned how to be a pro bike rider. We raced in China a fair bit with Bernie Sulzberger, Johnny Cantwell, Aaron Kemps, guys like that, and you just learn the ropes, yeah.
Jayco AIS.
Yep, Jayco AIS. Yeah, yeah.
Talk to us about that. What was that like?
Oh yeah, it was different. JV runs a very tight ship. so we're very organized, but it was interesting. Yeah, I think I only had really like I was helping Jay McCarthy and Rowan Dennis out a fair bit because of my size, I was good at riding the front. Couldn't climb. We're racing Italy. Just getting Mars handed to me every time we race. But I was good at riding in front, controlling the bunch, helping out Jay to get to the climb in good position, and then we'd deliver him, and then he'd deliver the results, which was pretty cool. I only had one breakthrough result that season. It was really a Olympias tour.
Second overall.
Overall. It was pretty funny because we went into that riding for Rowan, but then Rowan and I got in a fight that. Like 2 days before the race, and I said, nah, not riding for him. Stuff him, not riding for him. And then,
what was the fight about? What were you guys rocking horns for?
I, to be honest, I don't know. I think it was just like...
just young kids in Italy, been on the road for a while.
That's it. Rowan was having a bad day and I was having a bad day and we just set off fireworks. So.
Was there anyone there like mediating it or was it just...
No, going at it? Yeah, it just escalated. But it was pretty funny actually. And then, so I had free rein all tour and I just went out and had a crack. It was pretty cool.
And at this point, you'd stop your track ambitions. That was 2012, so that was London. You weren't looking towards that at all?
Yeah, that was pretty unfortunate. Like, so I was world champion in 2011, but then I didn't get to... in their wisdom, they decided that because the race was in Melbourne, they didn't need a qualifier spot for the world championships that year. So even though I was world champion, they were like, nah, we're not going to take you. We're going to put someone else in instead, which is I thought was a little bit rude.
Yes.
So defending world champ doesn't get his spot. But look, that's what it is. But what really got me was that when Olympic camp was only like a couple of weeks after Olympia's tour. So that was the tour I was going really well in. We trained all season to peak towards Olympic camp. I showed I had the form. But then didn't get selected for Olympic camp even, not team, to be able to show it. So, yeah, a bit disappointed. And that, I think that was the turning point where you sort of like build everything up for a certain race and then you get told, nah, sorry, not going to happen because we already select the team or we don't think you're going to be good enough. And that's when I was like, all right, we're going to have to do something. And I invented the air hub, basically, for the second half of that season. I was like, far out, I'm going to have to learn to climb, you know.
They told you, you're just simply not good enough, you're not up to the level.
No, they didn't say it like that, but they wanted to take the guys that already selected. I got the phone call. I remember the room I got phone call in. It was in the Netherlands, literally on the last day of the tour, where I just ran second overall.
Yeah.
Best results since Henk Vogel was in 96 or something. Second, and they got three podiums, and it's a bit unfortunate. So
coming towards the end of that season, were you thinking, I'm not going pro on the road? Was that still an ambition for you to go world tour? Was any teams knocking on your door after that Olympia's tour result? Or was it getting pretty dry?
Yeah, well, the thing is I didn't have many results. I only had that one result, and that's really not enough to cut it. And you can see that. Like, a lot of guys don't go pro, and I simply didn't have the results. I was like, oh, I'm going to take a year off. I'm going to build my air hub because I got to be able to climb better. And so for a big guy, it's about putting out more power. You got to put out more power on the flats and then the hills will start getting easier. And the air hub was supposed to be like a one-year project, but it ended up turning out to be 4 or 5 years.
So midway through 2012 was when you started that project?
Just when I started thinking about it, and then we got stuck into it 2013, yeah.
So how do you go from thinking about it to starting it, and who were you doing with? Where was the funding from?
Yeah, it actually takes a fair bit of time to get the ball rolling and like commit, because it's a pretty audacious like idea. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm just gonna reinvent the wheel because I reckon I can do it. So going from like having a concept and all these little concept sketches, I remember doing the concept sketches in the apartment in Italy, and going from that to actually putting it into practice. So I went home and I started like buying e-bike motors and trying to like reconfigure them and stuff like that. I remember having a light globe attached to an e-bike motor running in reverse, and you sort of like, yeah, trying to get some resistance that way. And I was like, okay, the concept is proved. Like, this feels unbelievable. Like, as soon as you ride that bike, you know, I'm getting a workout. It's so efficient. If I keep doing this every day, I'm going to be a better athlete and it'll take me no time at all to be a good climber. But going from something where I had to like modify my bike to a tool that I'll be able to reuse for the rest of my career, massive step. That's what the 3-4 years were.
So were you still training in this time you were doing?
Yeah.
Were you trying to race, or were you kind of just going full time?
Cycling's not a sport where you can just quit, go cold turkey, I think. So there was that petering period. I actually went across to Belgium and did some amateur Kermesses over there. And that was pretty cool. Got some good results in there. Like, I realized I love Belgium and that I can still race.
Good for you.
Yeah. Good for me as a rider. Suited me. But I really had to get this air hub finished because every day I didn't have it. And I knew how good it was. It just burnt on me. So I had to go and get it done just by the bullet.
So how did you get it done? What were you doing? How many hours were you putting in? Who was helping you? And when did you finish the project and say, this is the complete package and put on the market?
Yeah, I was really lucky because one of the guys that helped build my bikes, Aldo Contarino, he's a frame builder, a bit of an inventor himself. Absolutely an inventor. He's a brilliant guy. He gave me the push to start doing it. Tom is a good idea, but he didn't have the time to do it. So I had to go away and learn how to 3D draw. I bought myself a 3D printer. And so then I started printing parts and prototyping and thinking about it and basically tinkering until we had a concept. And then from that concept, we started refining it. So I had the 3D model in front of me, and then we had to make it out of aluminium and work out how the whole magnetic braking system was going to work. And then, once that got started, I had to hire some electrical engineers to do the complicated part where you connect the app to the hub. And they did all the circuit boards, made everything talk together. And then it was off to get it manufactured. And that's a real long project. Trying to find suppliers and guys to make, because everything in the hub's custom. That's why it's so expensive. You got to get 3D forging dies. You got to get 7 cavity extrusions with proper, like, a heat dissipating veins and things like that. And then you got to work out the airflow through the system and how to keep it cool and thermal regulating. Otherwise, your magnets will demagnetize and stuff like that. So many problems that when you go into it, you don't think about it. But they're actually key to making the system work.
So tell us what the actual product is.
So the AirHub, it's an on-road resistance training device. So what you can do with it is there's an app. We've actually got two models, but for starters, we've got an app, and you can connect the app to your heart rate monitor and power meter, and you can say, I want to hold 130 beats a minute, and the hub will automatically regulate the resistance to hold you at that heart rate. So if you've got a partner who's too slow or riding a different pace, or you're sitting at the wheel in a training camp, the hub will automatically turn on and apply resistance to hold you at that heart rate. It's scientific training, like lab-based training, but out on the road. You start to see it now with training programs. They become more complicated, more scientific to get those last few percent.
Yeah.
And the AirHub does that and allows you to do those without having to live in the mountains. You know, it costs you $1,000 a week to live in the mountains, and the AirHub does that for you at home.
Yeah. So you're obviously right into your training and all your numbers and stuff like that. Do you have any background in science or engineering at university? Did you do any courses?
No, I'm basically all self-taught. I went to university for a year, and that taught me how to learn. So when I do
that's
science...
That's what uni is, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's very hard to get a job out of uni without learning extra stuff.
Yeah.
So, like all my sports science stuff, you got to find it from the source. You got to read the papers, you got to understand it, you got to put all the Lego pieces together, and eventually, once you've read enough, you get a large enough picture, you talk to enough people, you email the sports scientists, you ask them for their perspective, and brings together a picture of what things are supposed to look like. And if you've got that ability to learn, what's that saying? If you've got an open mind and a Wi-Fi connection, anything's possible.
So when did the product become finished and go on the market?
A few people asked me this, actually. I think it was November 2015 or 2016.
Yeah.
I can't actually be sure, because I remember 2017 is when I raced nationals again. And then we went and raced track nationals, and this WA state team broke the national championship record. We did like a 55.9.
Wow.
So I don't think it would have been that year. So it must have been 2015.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this whole time you were doing the project with AirHub, you're always going to come back and hit road cycling hard again?
Yeah, at a point there, I'd completely given it up. And I was just happy doing my thing. Like, I was learning so much stuff about life and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, setting up manufacturing age is pretty crazy. There's just so much out there. There's so much you can do. And that was really exciting. But I think it was at Tour Down Under. I went and saw... I went to the Legends dinner, and I saw Sagan and Esteban Chavez and have a chat on stage at the Legends dinner. It was absolutely inspirational night. Like, that is the reason I'm here today.
Yeah.
Because watching these guys speak, and I got that gut feeling. I was like, I've left this sport too early. I got really emotional. And that's when I decided to come back.
Because how old were you? You would have only been about 25, 26 at that point?
No? Yeah. So like I'd done really well, and then I stepped away from the sport, and that was when I decided, no, we're going to have to come back. And so that would have been, 2016, Legends dinner.
Yeah.
And then I basically built up the training all that year. I mean, I got the air hub now. It's like training camp all year round.
Yeah. So you train with that? You train with that every day?
Basically every day. Yep. Yeah. Depending on, I don't train with it every day at the moment. I train with it like maybe 2 or 3 times a week.
Yeah.
Because I'm doing more volume. But back then I was only doing like 15 hours a week or 10, 15 hours a week. So I train with it basically every day.
Yeah.
And you get stronger and stronger and stronger. And then we trained up to try and match Durbo when he came back for preseason. So me and my mates, we got about like 2 weeks where Durbo steps out of off season into preseason, where we can beat him up a little bit before he gets too strong again. we trained up for that, and then I raced nationals and had some really good form, and then held that through to track nats. And me, Stevie Hall, Cam Meyer, and Welsford, we did a 3:55.9, which is pretty quick for a state team.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did like one training session together and like, all right, boys, all in. And then it was on to Oceania's, and that's when ACJ, Andrew Chris Johnson, picked me up.
So you got picked up sort of not halfway through, but a few months into the season.
Yeah.
Got with Andrew.
I decided that like mid-year I was going to go to Belge. So I'd trained really hard through pre-season. I was going to go to Belge, race some Kamesas, and just enjoy racing again. And then I bumped into Andrew at Oceania's and had an over the fence conversation. He's like, yeah, sure. Tag along. Yeah. And then they signed me up and helped us out with some bikes, and yeah, we went over and raced in Europe. So
how did you find your time with Andrew's team? Everyone that goes there always seems to do so well.
Yeah.
It's a good setup, isn't it?
Yeah. It's so well drilled. Andrew's pretty highly strung, but that's what makes the team great. Like, you know, he wants you to succeed.
Yeah.
And he'll get the best out of you. Yeah. So it's pretty impressive, like lining up with 8K to go in Tour of China against these pro Connie teams who are really well funded, and we're just like the, you know, Ben Long bandits there.
These cowboys.
Cowboys boxing on.
So you had a few good results in China, was it? There was a couple of podiums. Was that 2017 or 2018?
Yeah, so 2017, had a couple of podiums. Tour Hainan, which is like a 2.HC. Got a podium there, which was cool. Don't know how, like, it was big.
Just bunch. Big, filthy bunch gallops.
Big, filthy bunch gallop. Got rolled by Merezco and guy from Yukio, I think. That was pretty cool result.
Yeah.
We had a great week that year. I actually crashed out, remember? Yeah, me and AJ crashed out on day 4. So I think we got 3 podiums in 4 days. And like all the other pro Connie teams, like, oh my God, like, who are you guys? You're just a Connie team and we're pro Connie and we're like, and you're can't like get anything. Yeah. it's just AJ is ridiculous. Hey? The guy's so fast.
Yeah, he is. Train, but he loves it.
Yeah.
what sort of rider did you think you were going to come back as? Did you have a kind of a plan to what you were going to come back as? Was it going to be like a road sprinter or like a kind of a classics kind of rider? Did you have a kind of a mold that you wanted to get into?
The classics has always really excited me. Like, it's just like you can't fake your way through a 6-hour race.
No.
Like, 6-hour race is hard all day.
Yeah.
And one of the most impressive things is like, was it Van Avermaet, I think? He podiumed in 3 classics or semi-classics in 5 days. Like,
he loves racing, that guy. He's such a good racer.
It's incredible just being able to go, all right, you know, Saturday we're going to race full gas for 5 hours, and then Wednesday we're going to do it again, and then we're going to do it again on Friday. Like, I can barely train that for 6 hours, 3 days a week, but let alone race it full gas in the rain in Belgium. Yeah, it's so impressive. Yeah, and that's what I wanted to be like.
So talk us through the build-up to Nationals this year. Was it something that you targeted maybe in September? You're like, I'm going to go hard at Nationals. I'm going to be a factor in the race. Or you're never actually thinking that you could do a good number there?
Yeah, so it was all pretty well planned. You can't sort of like chance your way through these events. So it started with Nationals last year. We had the Tour Down spot, Ben Long, and we're like, yeah, buddy, let's do this. Let's cut a bit of weight and let's get a start at TDU. And I had great form, great race. I was hitting some unreal numbers. And then we finished the road race and Andrew goes, sorry, boys, CA forgot to put your rego in properly and none of you guys know whereabouts.
Big mess, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Huge mess, that.
Yeah. Anyway, that was a big disappointment. But, it is what it is. And then, continued that season on. But this year I was like, all right, we're good last year, but we come into it a bit top-end heavy. let's get a bit more mid-range for this one. It's one of those races where you can't work out what's going on, so I'm just going to have to throw fitness at it. Be fit, be ready to race, and we'll see how we go. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
When I say throw fitness at it, it was a lot of fitness. We threw a lot of fitness at it. A lot of training, a lot of sacrifice to get even close to coming off with a win.
Do you coach yourself?
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. And also, you put yourself on whereabouts. Is that true?
Yep.
Did you hit up Cycling Australia and ask them to put you on their testing pool and they said no, and then you went... What was the story there? You can tell it better than anyone.
Yeah, so I hit up all three selectors, Simon, Brad, and Rick Fulcher. Had a couple of long conversations with Simon and Brad and told them I was going to be fit and ready, and I was chaining the house down, and that, you know, I was going to be the best non-pro rider at Nationals, getting ready for that TDU spot as it has been the other years. Brad just plainly said, we're focusing on the under-23s for the whereabouts spot. We've only got 10 of them. Sorry, you know, we've only got 10 spots. Can't do anything for you. But at the same time, I'd also emailed ASADA, and ASADA told me to contact the UCI to check if they had any spots left. So that's what I did. Caught up the UCI, and they were able to reactivate my account from when I was back world champion, because I was on whereabouts then as well.
Yeah.
And yeah, ticked the box. So I was, yeah, happy, ready to race. And, so and I kept going, kept charging.
You've just backed yourself in that much that you've put yourself on whereabouts.
Yeah, yeah, you kind of had to.
That's so good.
The training I was doing was a bit ridiculous.
Really? As hard as you've ever trained before?
No, it's harder than I've ever trained. Like, yeah, there's no point. There was like a couple of, it was like a 1700 TSS week there in like week four of a training, a 6 week training block. It was just, yeah, phenomenal stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, so I was pretty, going pretty hard.
Yeah. Yeah. So on the day of the Nationals, what were you thinking? Were you thinking, I'm going to have to get in the early break? That's the only way I can sort of secure that first non-pro spot? Or was there another race plan teed up?
So I was like, oh, I might just go hard for the last 2 hours. I'll get around the first part and go hard for the last 2 hours. That was the plan the day before the race. And then that night, the night before the race, I woke up and I was like, nah, looking at that start sheet, Michelin's going to have to go from the gun.
Yeah.
They haven't got a protected sprinter like the last couple of years. They're going to have to go full gas, 16 laps. So I'm just going to have to get up there and hold on. And we talked about that in the team meeting, like, guys, it's going to be full gas. You got to get in it. And that's ended up what happened on the day. So, yeah, there's no hiding there.
How hard was it to get into that move? Because the guys that were in the front were some serious bike riders.
Yeah. So I actually missed it. I was, fooling around down the back there at the start line, as you do sometimes. And, neck minute, 30 guys go down the road. You're like, oh, boy, we've stuffed this one up real bad. When 30 guys go down the road, what do you do? Anyway, I had to wait. I had to be calm, and I was not calm. And I had to wait till the next lap round. And the next lap round, I think five or six of us went across. I think it was like me, Harper, Durbo, Mark O'Brien, Nathan Haas, and Ben O'Connor. And Ben O'Connor just like lit the rocket. I was like full gas, 5 minutes across the break. And that was it. Yep. And that was the race done. I think Cam actually missed us. We got across, and then Cam was coming across by himself. And as soon as he got there, the six Michelin guys who were already in the break just hit the front, boof, and solidified it straight away.
And then that final four was an interesting kind of dynamic, wasn't it? You were there with Durbo. So he's your brother-in-law.
Yep. Brother-in-law.
How was that been out there with him?
That was actually pretty cool. What happened was, I think Harper launched an attack on the home straight just over the crest of that little rise before we dropped down, and Edmo was straight onto it. And then I was like, oh boy, this is deja vu from last year. I ain't gonna let that go anywhere. So I was straight onto that. And then Durbo was right after me. And then we got a gap, and we just committed, and then it was surreal. I'm like, you just let the most dangerous break in the combination in the race go down the road.
So
it was pretty funny. We didn't have to talk to each other the whole race. Everyone knew what the deal was. You just ride and can keep us away. I think we sat at about 2 minutes. That was what must have been the Mitchelton plan, hold it at 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And we just floated around that most of the day, yeah.
Talk us through the last couple of laps.
started off with dropping my chain. Coming out of the university, we kicked, so it was an attack. And then that was when Cameron and the two other guys, Jace and Connor, got across. And then I've gone following an attack and just dropped the chain, and it's got wrapped up around my crank, and I had to stop, untangle it, then chase back on through the convoy. And then that's when Harper did his first attack, which was a bit scary. Four laps out, getting sucked into it. And I was like, oh.
It's a bit early, like, boys.
The early boys. Anyway, that shelled Connor and Jace. And then Harper attacked. I don't know if he attacked that lap again, over the top. And everyone was a bit fried because to respond to that first attack, I had to basically go full sprint, 40 seconds.
Yeah.
And then Harper was away. Edmo started chasing. And then Derbs had to ride the front for a lap to try and bring him back. But yeah, I was cramping pretty hard on that last lap, going up a climb. Like, my right leg was almost fully locking. yeah, I don't know if people saw it on the video, but it wasn't pretty. So I went to the front and rode it. I don't know why, but maybe just to stop the surges.
Yeah.
Had to go through my pockets for something to eat, like a gel or some salt.
Something to blow up, were you?
Oh, just not much. Just my leg was just locking. Like, I couldn't put any power down with the right leg, so just pedaling one legged, basically. And then we've gone over the top, and Harper's hit us, and I've just sat 20 metres off the back for most of the climb, and then Cam's driven over the top and just solidified it straight out of 50 metres.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I was in a bit of trouble there.
Did you have it under control enough, though, that you thought, if I can just hold this tempo, keep him just there, it just might come back?
No, not at all.
No?
No.
You thought you were just racing for third?
Oh, absolutely. I was trying to not get caught for fourth, actually. I was like, far out, I'm going to have to race Derbo in the kick and fourth and try and get myself on the podium. But we got over the top there, and then I started doing what we'd practice in training where, you know, I didn't focus so much on the top end 10-minute power this year like I did the year before. And it was more on 40-minute effort, so that if I did get dropped over the top, I would be able to lock in and ride back on. I mean, it sounds easy, like, after the event, but, you know, at the time it was like battle stations. Just
Yeah, after 4 hours already.
Yeah, battle stations, do whatever you can. Get your head down, get aero and start chasing. and that's it. And then I started first seeing them fool around a little bit on gear af. And that's when I got my first sniff. I was like, maybe we can do something here. But then all hopes were dashed again when we went down the other side and I didn't even see him turning the uni. So I was racing blind through the uni and back out onto the main road. And they're on the wrong side of the road again. And I was like, oh, they're screwing around. Block headwind, uphill. And I gave it everything. But it's one thing that kept going through my mind was earlier that day in the women's race, I think it was Shara Gillo who got fourth. She was rolled just on the line by Sarah Roy in the last 10 metres. So I was like, I just got to keep fighting because I got till the last 10 metres of this bike race to go sniff myself second. So I'm going to have to go all the way to the line because someone might sit up early and just, because they've had enough. And I think everyone's seen the video. So
that's what you're thinking when you come back on to these blokes with 500 to go. Were you planning to just like sit on, and then you got there and you're like, holy shit, I'm going like twice the speed of these blokes. I'm just going to hit them. Was it like a split second decision? Like,
yeah, absolutely. Like, I come down that hill and I really hadn't planned for that situation. Like, in training over the last couple of months, you like think about, okay, who's going to be the main competitors at nationals? I'm like, Camp's obviously going to be the guy. Like, he's absolutely demolishing all the time trials around Perth at the moment. So he's going to be the man for the race. And I'm like, how am I going to beat Cam in a two-up kick? We're about 50-50 at the moment. So there's been a few times where I've rolled him, and there's been other times where he's absolutely smoked me in a two-up. And coming in and catching them with speed wasn't in the race plan at all. Hadn't run that one. That wasn't in my flip book of tactics. So we come into that, and then I hadn't worked it out yet, but I was coming in so hot. I went to grab the brakes to slow down. I was like, what are you doing? I'm going to just hit him, all right? And so I flicked to the other side of the road and, just punched from the seat.
Just put the head down.
Head down, get the head out of the way and see what you got. I was convinced that Cam was going to be on the wheel. So that's why I kept looking back. You don't
just come over the top of you.
Yeah. I sort of was like, all right, I can give it a boost for maybe 20 seconds to see what I got. And if Cam's on the wheel, I'm going to have to sit up and then check where we're at and then maybe try and sprint him. But it seems like I came in with that much speed that I wasn't even paying attention. And we got a gap and, yeah, all the way to the line. Pretty cool.
What was it like winning, like actually winning the national
Total surprise. Surreal, absolutely. Like, you don't even think about that. You can't even comprehend it. Like, you're delusional if you think you're going to go out there and win the national title.
Yeah.
But, yeah, crossing the line and then, Mackenzie was there and ecstatic. And I'm like, oh, we have to do an interview now? Seriously? Yeah.
Just let me enjoy it.
Yeah. It was sweet.
And you train with Durbo and Cam in WA. What was that like, racing those blokes and then training with them? Sort of, you know, in the build-up, was that kind of weird?
Not really. I mean, we've done a couple of years before where it's like so cutthroat on race day. So cutthroat. Like,
you're not mates anymore.
No, not mates, mate. We're worst enemies. Like, we hate each other. The banter before going into the race is pretty strong as well. It's cutthroat. But yeah. No, we're all good back home and we all love it. We talk about the race in the lead-up to it, what's going to happen, what's not going to happen. And then, on the day, everyone does their thing and commits to their team and gives 100%.
So after the race, are you thinking TDU? Like, surely I'm going?
Oh, I thought definitely I was going. Like, we had a bit of a joke that looking at the press release that coming out from CA, it's like, oh, there's only one spot left. So if there's two spots, maybe I could, like, run a drum, like, get second or something.
Yeah.
And maybe snivel a spot, you know, to help out the guys. Like, we've raced at that level of sport for... Well, a few years now, so I can get through the pack, I can do lead outs, I can put climbers into position and everything, and really hold my own against the World Tour guys. But with only one spot remaining, I was like, oh, we're probably gonna have to win the thing to be able to get a spot.
Yeah.
And then we did. A bit strange not to get it in the end.
When did they tell you that you weren't doing it?
The next day. Simon and Brad came in to my hotel and had us had a sit-down meeting to discuss it. Yeah.
It must have been hard, like, thinking that you've literally done everything. You've won the Nationals. How can I not get picked?
Like, yeah, I mean, there's just, like, it's just so strange, like, man, bit delusional as well. You know, you win the biggest race in the country. Like, there's not you can't sign up for any harder race or bigger race. The guys there were on form. Like, Luke was there and the next day he put 20 seconds into the world time trial champion.
Yeah.
Like, Cam's been training for this for months. Like, Chris Harper's been training for a whole 12 months for this race. Yeah. And to go win it and then not get a spot. Like, there's really no other box I can tick. I was national road series champion the year prior as well, a year and a half prior.
Put yourself in the testing pool.
Put myself in the testing pool. Done everything.
Ticked every box.
Yeah, I mean, anyway, delusional, but it is what it is.
Yeah. So we're here at Cadell Evans Great Ocean Road Race now with the national team. What are your plans here? Are you going to get stuck into it?
Yeah, really looking forward to it. But first World Tour race, I'm really nervous. It's not like you can have a warm-up. Well, we had a bit of a warm-up yesterday, but... Yeah, it'll be interesting just to see what it throws at us. Still trying to work out, you know, who the main guys are, who the protected riders, and try and follow some of them.
Yeah. This will be released after the race, so you can tell us your tactics if you want, and then when we drop this next week, you look like a king if it all comes off.
Just follow Viviani, I reckon. He's the informed guy. He's got an unreal team around him. So, hopefully hang out with him for as long as possible. Who else is there? Oh, I was looking at...
It's a weird kind of race, isn't it? It's a race that could go, like, Peter Kanau's won solo, then there's also been a group of 25 guys arrive
quick
guys.
Impey's going to be the next guy. I reckon put him up there. And then I know just Ellison and Poles is going to absolutely tear us a new one on the last climb, I reckon. Yeah. But, it'll be interesting. I have to look at the start list, have a talk to Brad, see what he reckons. So, yeah.
What's the goals for Michael Freeberg after this? Are you still chasing that World Tour contract? That's still what you want to do?
Yeah, well and truly. Bigger and better things. I mean, like, you I reinvented the wheel to become a better athlete.
Yeah.
So there's nothing to hide there. I'm putting everything in. I know what works for me training wise now. Do the work, you get the results. So yeah, and you know how to fight for things, work things now. I mean, like, I put in so much work into the air hub, you just bring that across to bike racing. You know, if you one winter there, I didn't see the sun because in the workshop from dusk till dawn. Seriously, like, I got pasty white because I didn't see the sun because working so hard. So I mean, like, bike riding's easy compared to that. You don't have to sit in a desk all day. So yeah, and that's what I'm going to do, go train, get bigger, better.
You're looking to get to Europe this season?
Oh, well, surely. Yeah.
What's the plan?
About six, funny story, actually, 6 months ago, me and my girlfriend were like, all right, let's do this Europe thing next year. And so she quit her job. She actually finished up a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
And she's got contract worth in Perth for 3 months. And then we're going to have Girona through the summer, and I'll fly in and out of Belgium, race Camases, wait for the ACA, Australian Pro Racing Sunshine Coast guys to come across, and then I'll hook up with them.
Cool. Michael Freiberg, thanks for joining us on the podcast. All the best with your season, and hopefully we can see you in the World Tour, because what we saw in January, the start of January, you're definitely up to it, so we wish you all the best.
Ah, thanks, mate. Hopefully I can do the jersey proud.
Good luck.
Cheers.